Welcome to We Chat Divorce, hosted by Karen Chalou, Legal Liaison, and Catherine Shanahan, CDFA. Each episode, we sit down with divorce professionals and industry experts to provide insights and frank discussions about real people, real situations, and real divorce to help you achieve your best life post-divorce. This episode of We Chat Divorce is brought to you by My Divorce Solution, offering divorce financial planning so clients can secure the divorce settlement they deserve. Visit mydivorcesolution.com to request access.
Welcome to We Chat Divorce. Today, Catherine and I welcome Carrie Jacobson, the founder and CEO of Jacobson Family Law, where she is a best interest attorney, a child advocate attorney, and certified mediator. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Our episode today is all about how prenuptial agreements can keep the drama out of the divorce process. So in this episode, we're going to talk about ways a prenup agreement can reduce conflicts during divorce, steps couples should take before drafting a prenuptial agreement, and how to tailor a prenuptial agreement to meet the needs of each couple. But first, let's meet Carrie. Carrie has been practicing law for over a decade, having successfully represented clients in all facets of family law proceedings in Maryland. She works with clients by listening to their concerns and helping them identify their goals and interests for the divorce process, as well as the future beyond it. Carrie is skilled in a variety of dispute resolution options and helps identify what divorce process is best for her clients' need. So again, Carrie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Carrie, we like to start our conversations with our podcast guests by asking you to share a little bit of your story and how you came to your career path in the family law industry.
Sure. So I have known since I was probably in late elementary, early middle school that I wanted to be an attorney. My mom actually started working for an attorney at that point in time as a legal secretary. And that just interested me. However, she worked for a divorce attorney. And I was like, that seems like the most boring thing ever. I don't know. Why would anybody want to do that? So my intention had been to go to law school, become a prosecutor, and then eventually make my way onto the bench. However, my parents are also divorced, and I ended up taking sociology classes in college. And so the family law world really resonated to me once I made it to law school. And I no longer really wanted to take that criminal path, though I think a lot of divorce attorneys or attorneys would say criminal clients are actually easier in a lot of ways than family law clients. So. And I've actually been a mediator since I was in high school. So it's just all kind of been combined with one another.
That's awesome. The gift of committing your practice to families is really commendable. And, you know, a lot of family law attorneys, as we all know, are kind of assigned to that in their firm for a variety of reasons. So, you know, to meet you where this is your chosen path really speaks volumes.
Well, I'm curious, if you don't mind me asking, I give, you know, your mom a lot of kudos here for being an inspiration for you or being just a role model. But even her working in a law firm, was their divorce process something that encouraged you even more that you wanted to help people do it better or do it different, or that, you know, did that have any fuel behind your desire?
Probably a little bit. I will say that as divorces go, now that I've, you know, have been in this field for so long, theirs was not as contentious as many of them. They weren't in, you know, litigation for extended periods of time and that sort of thing. However, there were periods of time where, you know, they were not as amicable as they could have otherwise been. Mm-hmm. And so seeing how litigation can really tear families apart and the, you know, the toxic environment it can produce for kids is really the reason I, you know, chose to focus our firm on the alternative dispute resolution.
That's great. And that, you know, I always say to the clients that come to MDS, you know, working with our team members is really the advocacy for the children of divorce, right? You get these families to do it just a little bit better than the archaic system that's set up right now. Gosh, we're really doing a good job for a million people out there getting divorced every year.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the impact is so long lasting, right? So it really is, how can we focus on the kids and make that a better solution for them?
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that little backstory for us. It's, I think our listeners will benefit, and, you know, certainly we benefit. So we're talking today about prenuptial agreements. And typically when that topic comes up, people kind of bristle and say, oh, that just means we're just setting ourselves up to get divorced. We vehemently say not so.
Right.
What's your perspective on that?
I think, you know, really there are those myths out there about prenuptial agreements, that they're really only for people who have a lot of assets, that they're unromantic, or because you distrust the other, you know, person. And I'm trying to change the narrative around prenuptial agreements, because, you know, we all see that one of the most common reasons why people divorce is around finances, because they don't have conversations about them. And the way that I really see prenuptial agreements is opening up those lines of communication to talk about it at the outset. So if nothing else, everybody's on the same page with what they're going to do.
What's your take on, I'm hearing a lot of buzz, you know, it's a wedding world around here now, right? All of our friends' kids are getting married. Right. And that is the dinner conversation when we go out, especially if I'm sitting there, they want to ask me my opinion, financially speaking, about a prenup. What is your, you know, they're afraid of like my estate going to my son-in-law, right? That's what they're concerned about.
Yep.
And they struggle with making their children get prenups.
Yeah. So there are ways to protect inheritance from the marital distribution, but you have to be very conscious of it, and do it the right way if you don't have that prenup. Right. So as long as you take that money and you put it in that special designated account, what I'm sure you all have seen and what I have seen is just the not knowing. And then you put that marital bonus in the same account, and now the whole thing is commingled. And so that's really the fear of not having the prenup. So if someone's going to be very diligent, and you know, protect those assets, they can do it, but you have to be really mindful of it.
So is a prenup a better way to go in those particular types of situations? And, you know, we can talk about globally all of the situations, but in what Catherine's specifically talking about, is a prenup a better way to go?
It really is seeking clarity, right? So usually in a prenup, you're going to specify that the inheritance is going to be a separate asset. And typically there's some language in there that says that even if it does happen to go into an account, that it's going to maintain its separate or non-marital status. So is that extra layer of protection that's usually bound in the prenup that's not necessarily in, you know, that you have otherwise.
That's a really good, that's a very good point. I want to ask you this. So we have a lot of clients coming through the process, they're getting prepared and they have a prenup. Mm-hmm. And it's always, you know, why we're gathering the documentation to support the information in the prenup and what's not in there. We say to them, you know, you need your attorney consult to see how legit is the prenup. And it always amazes me, and probably you, Karen, as well, the difference of opinions between attorneys. Oh yeah, we could fight this one. Oh no, we can't fight this one. Oh no, you did this one in that state, so now you're in this state. Like, how do you know whether your prenup is really has grounds to stand on, because we just come from a financial point of view and then we want to consider it. But, you know, we hear just so many different versions of how do you tell if your prenup will actually hold up in divorce?
It really will depend on the jurisdiction, but it's a contract, right? And if both parties had an opportunity to review that contract with an attorney, if they chose to do so, then in most situations, it's probably going to be valid. Now, if they were given the contract on the eve of the marriage, then you have a different situation, right? Were you under duress when you signed it? Or had you been looking at this thing and talking about it for months ahead of time, right? So just because you didn't choose to get an attorney at the time that you were negotiating it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be invalid. But, you know, I have seen the scenario of the week of, oh, by the way, I want you to sign this. And that's really going to be challenging.
So the date on that as compared to the date of your marriage would then be important, right?
That is absolutely one of the things that we're looking for.
Yeah.
So from that base, Carrie, what are the fundamental requirements of a prenuptial agreement?
Most importantly is the financial disclosure. So did both people disclose all of the assets that they had at that time? Because if you're asking the other person to waive their interest in something, they need to know what it is that they're waiving their interest in. I've had scenarios where a potential client was like, well, do I have to disclose everything? Yes, we have to disclose everything, right? So you want to make sure that everything is listed. We generally list, you know, everything from bank accounts, retirement accounts, houses, cars, and even income at that point in time, because that can also be a large disparity. Generally, they need to be witnessed by at least one, if not two other people. I think it may depend on the state whether or not it needs to be notarized. I commonly require them to be notarized just to make sure that that person is the person that they say that they are signing. And then there's a little, I've seen scenarios where if they do have like a 401k already, or I'm in Maryland, so we see a lot of thrift savings plans, a requirement to sign again after the marriage has taken place. Because I think the theory is you can't waive your interest in something that you don't yet have an interest in. So in order to waive your interest in those retirement accounts, to also sign like a one pager right after the fact.
Oh, wow. What if they don't?
I've not seen it become an issue, but it's an extra layer of protection.
Yeah. Yeah. I never heard that before. What about those prenups that, you know, when we're looking at it, and again, we come from a financial lens, so it'll say the assets, or it'll just have a brief thing and it'll mention an exhibit, but there is no exhibit. So we can't compare what they have now to what was supposed to be in the exhibit.
Yeah. I mean, it really should have the exhibit on it, because that's going to be the full financial disclosure. And so, you know, it should be there somewhere.
So if you were an attorney and you received that with no exhibit, would you be stop, like, wait, somebody has to produce this exhibit to me?
I would say so. Yeah. Because that's the financial disclosure. If that wasn't acknowledged, then what are they waiving, or what are, you know, what's included in that prenup?
Right. Right. Yeah.
So Carrie, when they disclose their assets and debts on, you know, at the time of the agreement, is it also required that they produce documentation to support that disclosure, or is it taken at face value?
It's generally taken at face value.
Okay.
So we have a few situations where we see prenups with clients who had real estate, but then since that date of marriage, that real estate has been sold and another property has been purchased mm-hmm. with that same money. Mm-hmm. So can that, the person who listed the original property, can they back it out even though it's been sold and purchased? You know, if it was 200,000 and now you sold it and you bought one that's worth 400, are they allowed to back out the 400 that was mentioned in a prenup that no longer exists?
It very possible, depending on what the language is in the agreement, because oftentimes what I see is that the language will say if that separate property then goes on to have further games and is continued to be traced, then that's going to continue to be a separate asset.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, oftentimes there's like a clause that says that if it becomes a joint property, right? Like if they move that, so if they sold that money, sold that house, they put those proceeds into a joint bank account, that joint bank account is then a marital asset. And it's a question of whether or not it was commingled. But again, it would depend on the language. It may carve it out as being continued to be separate property.
Mm.
That's very interesting. Carrie, what about the term sunset clause?
I don't typically come around those too often.
Okay. We hear them in the South a lot.
I'm trying to remember if I've ever had a scenario where there's a sunset clause. So what I have seen is that every once in a while, there may be an agreement that says if we're married more than X number of years, then this is what's going to happen. Right. And if we're married less than that, then it's going to be this division, whether it's a division of assets or even potentially an alimony clause. I'm not sure if that's the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it is. Yeah.
Prevent the term before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's probably, from my experience, more prevalent in the South than it is in the North or Northeast.
Yeah.
All right. So we've talked about, oh, go ahead, Catherine.
I was just going to say, you know, in your practice, how many prenups do you have coming through? Has it increased a lot over the last couple of years?
It has increased. And I will actually say what we see, probably the largest increase, because they weren't very common before, are postnuptial agreements.
Oh, I wanted to touch on that, but I didn't know if we were allowed to today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I am seeing an increase in postnuptial agreements from people who are generally happily married. It's just most commonly they're coming into play if one or both of the spouses start businesses during the marriage and they want to protect that business interest. So that's where we've seen an uptick in that activity.
You know, I had an assessment call yesterday and they've been married 30 years. She's 60, he's 63. They have a farming industry, right? A farming business. And she doesn't want necessarily the business and he doesn't want her to have it, but she wants income for the rest of her life, right? Or she would take it in the form of income, I should say. And she doesn't even know if she wants to divorce. She's thinking about it. And so, you know, I did say that to her, you know, at my divorce solution, sometimes your solution is not to get a divorce. Maybe you need a postnup and you'll go to an attorney with your portrait and say, here's what it is. And here's the financial life I want to live, although right. different than him. So you can live two different financial lives and stay married with a postnup. And I think it's a great solution for a lot of people with businesses like that.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's there as protection as well, because in the event in the future, either of them do proceed with a divorce, then they've already resolved what that's going to look like.
Yeah. Is there a provision in a postnup that if you stay married, just, you know, you just want this financial arrangement, and then one of the parties pass away, you still have the marital right to that property? Or does a postnup kick in then?
So even if you do a postnup, similar to a prenup, it doesn't necessarily specify, I mean, it can if the parties agree, but it doesn't necessarily specify what's going to happen for the inheritance. A lot of times there's a waiver, but if you do an estate plan in addition to that, then the estate plan is going to trump the postnup or prenup language. So, you know, they could have their estate plan, whether it's a trust or a will, that specifies what's going to happen to those assets upon either of them passing away.
Okay. And that trumps the postnup.
Yep. Usually the postnup will say, you know, what the language we typically see is we waive our interest into inheritance, but that in no way prevents us from having an estate plan that says otherwise.
Mm.
Very
That's good
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, on that business topic, I think a lot of people don't realize this, but if there are businesses in existence, especially with third parties, sometimes those operating agreements or shareholders agreements would almost mandate a prenup because of the divorce provisions in the those agreements. Have you experienced a lot of that?
I haven't experienced it, but I definitely understand why that would be, because one of the biggest concerns when you're, you know, have a business is how is a divorce going to impact that? If that one stakeholder is now going through a divorce and they have to pay their spouse half of their interest in it, where is that going to come from? Mm-hmm. And are there other assets that they're going to be able to pay that from? Or are they going to have to somehow, you know, is that going to impact their business interest? So yeah, and see why that would be very important.
Yeah. Okay. So have a couple approaching marriage, or a couple who's married and want to talk about a postnuptial agreement. You know, how do we change the narrative? How do we have good conversations that don't negatively emotionally impact that relationship as historically, you know, established, right? Because we've all said having these types of conversations by default say, well, you don't trust me, right? You don't. Yeah. So how do we change that narrative?
I think it's in the approach, right? It's not, I want to keep my assets and you're going to keep yours. It's more of a, I want us both to be protected in the event this happens. And it's not that we, you know, want to embark on a divorce, but the statistics are what they are. And, you know, it's really, I look at it as like an insurance policy. You don't want the terrible event to happen, but you have that protection in the event that it does.
Great analogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And mm-hmm. So one thing that we have also seen a lot of is people coming to mediation to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. So instead of both of them, you know, quote unquote, lawyering up, having that conversation in mediation about what they envision it to look like. And that could be everything from how they may approach separating the debts, how they're going to pay for expenses throughout the marriage. A lot of times people are waiting until later to get married. And so they already come into the marriage with a house or, you know, other assets. And so what's going to happen with that house if the non-owning spouse puts money into it? You know, capital improvements, what does that look like? So I think really having it as a conversation of not just a demand is,
you know, Carrie, that's what I love about the MDS portrait is because we do the exhibit, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Right. And so we have all that disclosure and all the we get the documentation though on our end to verify, because we have to verify the number. We're all, you know, financial people need to verify numbers. So with that in place, it's really easy for them to then go to you and say, help us mediate through this, right? You know, then you could talk, then you have the data all there. And because we make it an exercise, not such an embarrassing moment for anyone, to save space to share that information, and we have no judgment there, you know, then our team can send that over to you to do a really good conversation, to get everyone on the same page to what their thought process is, which is really what in turn will change the dialogue.
And it's just really, in my opinion, opening up those lines of communication, because so many couples don't have that financial conversation and they just kind of fall into what they fall into. And then, you know, 10 years later, it's like, well, why have we been doing it this way? It's because they never talked about how to do it any other way, and have different, you know, definitely different approaches to how they handle money. And so opening up the lines of communication at the outset so that they do get on the same page as to how they want to handle finances can even potentially prevent divorces in the first place.
Oh, I totally agree with you there, because it is finances and kids. So does it matter if you're married in Maryland and then you get divorced in South Carolina? Do you have to update anything if you move to a different state?
You shouldn't, because it's a contract, it's valid. You know, it's just when you move to that new state, that's going to be the law that, you know, applies.
Oh, that's the governing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's, you know, very interesting.
Contracts, you know, with someone else in a different state, a different company, and, you know, the contract is, in Delaware. So the Delaware law is going to apply or whatever the case may be.
So if I'm getting married in South Carolina, but I just love you so much and I want you to do it for me, does it matter? Can I have it? Can I have a prenup done in Maryland? Or do you have to do it in the state in which you get married?
Yeah. So typically it is done not necessarily where you're getting married, but where you intend to continue to reside. And now that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, 5 years later, you decide to move to Arizona, that it won't be valid. but, you know, if you're planning to go to Vegas to get married, but you're, you know, your residence is going to be South Carolina, then I would recommend that it be done in South Carolina.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. And if you don't have, if you're not going through mediation, it is most common that both parties would have their own attorneys to review the agreement. Usually it's the parties who are kind of, you know, making those negotiations and, you know, really just kind of using the attorney to answer any legal questions along those lines.
We saw a terrible case of a really smart woman that came through, marry someone and actually used his same attorney who drew up the agreement. And then they couldn't find the exhibit and it was supposed to be, I felt horrible for her. And they, all the attorneys on her side were saying, well, it's legit. That's why I asked you that. One of the reasons I asked that beginning question, you know who I'm talking about, Karen, right? Mm-hmm. That was just a terrible, it was so sad to see. And the differential in assets and income are like this now, this many years later. And,
you know, frankly, she didn't have the wherewithal to hire an attorney to dig into the legitimacy of the agreement. And so nobody wanted to take the case because they were up against spouse who had, you know, assets mm-hmm. for three or four lawsuits. And so, it was very unfortunate.
Yeah. Remember, she just loved him when they got married.
Yeah.
So she signed it.
So it's, you know, this all comes down to, you know, what you're talking about, Carrie, preparation. You know, people, if they just understand that preparation is really one of the most important steps to take. And even, you know, in preparing for divorce, we even talk to our clients about, you know, maybe it will be a post-nup, maybe it will be divorce, maybe it won't be anything, right. But having this knowledge is invaluable. So if you're preparing to get married, having the knowledge and having those financial conversations just lends itself to, first of all, to your point, a really strong relationship, but also not really ever having to wonder about it again or, you know, create distrust if something happens that you don't really understand. It really creates a good foundation, I believe. And I think that's what we're talking about today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's, you know, what people don't necessarily understand that is if they don't have, you know, this type of document that they have agreed upon as far as what's going to happen with the assets, the default is what your state law is, where you're living at the time of the divorce, right? And so it may be different than what you anticipated it being. And so it's also knowing what those laws are, because the state, if you don't have your own prenup, the state has one for you in by way of the divorce laws.
Oh, yeah, that's profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some are not so friendly. So yeah.
And quite expensive, right?
Like,
yeah. Well, this has been an excellent conversation, Carrie. How can our listeners find you and learn more about you?
Yes, so they can find us on our website, which is jacobsonfamilylaw.com. We're also on all the social media channels, including YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And so we try to get a lot of educational information out there for folks so that they know, you know, what their options are.
So this concludes our discussion on how prenuptial agreements can keep the drama out of the divorce process. Thank you so much for a fantastic conversation, Carrie.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you're considering divorce, make sure to protect your wealth with divorce financial planning from My Divorce Solution. Our certified divorce experts will help you untangle your finances and understand your settlement options so you can negotiate your marital assets with confidence. protect your financial estate with divorce financial planning. Visit mydivorcesolution.com to see if you qualify to work with our financial divorce experts. That's mydivorcesolution.com for expert divorce financial planning. Thanks for joining us on another episode of We Chat Divorce. We hope this episode was informative and supportive on your divorce journey. If you're looking for more support for navigating divorce with confidence and clarity, head over to mydivorcesolution.com for more podcast episodes, divorce events, and resources for your divorce. We'll see you back here for our next episode.